Welcome to the Decoding Culture Podcast. The podcast focuses on the importance that culture plays in all areas of business and society, from how it shapes organizations and work to how it influences consumer experience, innovation, design, and larger societal trends. My name is John Curran, and I'm your host. I'm a business anthropologist, executive coach, systemic team coach, facilitator, and trainer. I'm also the CEO of JC & Associates, which is a consultancy that helps businesses develop better working cultures and relationships with their stakeholders. Over 20 years ago, I spent 2 years carrying out ethnographic research in a psychiatric hospital in London. This was for my PhD in social anthropology, and to gain ethical approval in the hospital for my research, I had to become a member of staff, so I worked as a nursing assistant. And by working the shifts, I was able to get a feel of the daily rhythm of the hospital and how the often latent aspects of everyday culture shaped behaviour and perceptions around work, care, policy and power. I was also able to experience and understand some of the key elements that made nursing and medical teams form in different environments, from when the wards were calm to when teams had to work as units, when there were often challenging periods on the ward. Understanding how teams can work in challenging environments can help us learn more about culture of teams in general. What are the driving forces that make a team connect and become high-performing? And what elements of team culture challenge this unity? To help me unpack this further, I spoke to Professor Marc Durand, who is Professor of Organizational Ethnography at Cambridge Judge Business School at Cambridge University. Marc shares with me his experience of carrying out ethnographic research in Camp Bastion, which was a British army base in Afghanistan. Marc's area of focus was on the military medical team. He shares fascinating insights around how teams manage periods that demand focus compared to where periods are maybe less busy. He also describes the subtle cultural elements of teams that shape their identity. We also discuss the growing influence of ethnography in business schools and why this is important. This episode is the first of two with Marc. Episode 6 will focus on workplace conflict, what causes it, how can we understand it, and how can we manage it, especially when many of us are either working from home or having to work through the pandemic. Marc and I are both trained in workplace mediation, so this, with our ethnographic and culture hats on, provides some interesting listening. In the second episode, you will also hear where Marc will take his anthropologist's notebook. I hope you enjoy episode 5. Marc, welcome to the Decoding Culture podcast.
That's nice to be here. Thank you.
Fantastic. Okay, well, I guess we're starting off, I kind of ask this to all my guests, but whereabouts are you based? Where am I talking to you?
So I'm based in Cambridge, currently working very much from home like anyone else, but ordinarily I'd be teaching in the university and the business school. And you know, my role there is that of professor of organizational ethnography.
Can you tell me a little bit about that? I mean, look, I'm an anthropologist. I come from an ethnographic DNA. I saw this, Cambridge Judge Business School professor of organizational ethnography, and I fell off my seat with delight. So what does that entail? What type of, what's your kind of focus there of using and also teaching ethnography?
Yeah, so, you know, as you know, as an anthropologist, you know, when we write ethnographies, these ethnographies are based upon us having spent significant amounts of time embedding with people, different communities. It's a very old-fashioned way of doing research. You know, we learn by observation. And what we try to do as best we can is to try and understand how other people see the world, how they relate to that world, why they prioritize in the way they do, and how they make meaning in those worlds. It's forever going to be an imperfect science, if you call it a science. It's deeply personal. I think as ethnographers, in some ways, we will always be wrestling with the big questions of life. You know? Mm-hmm. How should we live our lives? You know, is there more than one way to live a life meaningfully? And if so, is something we can explore? You know, how do people decide between right and wrong? And these big questions of life, I think, to some extent, these are what anchor, I think, ethnographers. And maybe more than people in other professions. And I may be castigated for this, but I think it's probably what draws us to ethnography. It's the observation of human beings very much like us, mm-hmm. trying to make meaning and eke out an existence in a particular community at a particular time.
How does this sit within a business school? So, you know, I'm kind of thinking of the concept of ethnography within a business school. Is it, obviously there's value, but what value is this going to be leading students or MBA students who are situated within a business school?
Yeah, so it's a good question, right? So I think traditionally in business schools, you would find that research is predominantly quantitative. It's predominantly mainstream, which tends to often be quantitative. It's changing a little bit now, but ethnography has always occupied a very small corner in that large church. I think it's changing for a couple of reasons. I think number one, ethnography has a disproportionately large footprint, even in the organization sciences. So if you look at groundbreaking works, you find that quite a few of them are not only qualitative, but they're based on field work. Mm-hmm. And so we're showing up, I think, quite well. I think, secondly, with an increasing interest in grand challenges of getting business schools to become engaged with real people facing real problems, as opposed mm-hmm. to a more typical approach, which is let's look at the literature, find a gap, and fill that gap. I think when people become more interested now in engaging with real challenges, I think you'll find fieldwork being a very good way of doing so, because it brings you as close as you can get to real people, as I said, who are facing real difficulties in real life. You know? Mm-hmm. And so it's lovely to see a new generation of PhD students and junior faculty who are taking ethnography seriously. And it feels, you know, like it's experiencing a bit of a comeback, which is really, really nice to see.
Do you think, though, that, you know, we kind of shoot forward 5 years, or we'll see the kind of notion of leadership being one where actually you need that as part of your repertoire to be able to go and understand, observe, I don't know, we call it employee experience, or we talk about customer experience, or do you think that will still be siloed away, or leadership and business will be something separate from the doing and the actual empathy and those aspects?
I've no idea. I mean, I think generally many leaders would be a lot better off if you spend more time listening and watching as opposed to mm-hmm. dictating, telling. You know, and those are skills that come quite naturally to the ethnographer. You know, a lot of the time what we do is we try and disappear in the background, you know, mm-hmm. and we spend a lot of time using our humanity, so to speak, to build relationships. And part of that, of course, is to listen, to empathize, and trying to put ourselves into someone else's shoes. And that, I think, you know, is important, not just for the ethnographer, but potentially very valuable for leaders. I mean, in terms of MBA students, you know, since you asked the question, I think generally ethnography can work very well because it allows you to tell stories in a great amount of detail, much more than a case study could provide. And even though we can't generalize from those stories, you know, you can use the stories almost as if they were a mirror, you know, to mm-hmm. look to students and say, well, do you recognize yourself in what I'm telling you? And where and what. Mm-hmm. And it seems actually really quite effective, both with MBA students and also with executive audiences. You know, so it gives them something to think about and talk about and react to. You know, and I tell my students, you know, there's nothing I would rather have you do than and fight me on some of these issues. Let me be provocative. Let me tell you something, and you just push back as hard as you can. And the dynamic seems to work well.
I think there's something I can really resonate with that when I do work with leaders or kind of senior boards and try and bring them out and observe and understand the merit of being able to listen and observe, be it within their own organization or who they think their customer is. It's not about understanding needs, which is the market research innovation space, but it's actually about challenging your own perceptions and allowing yourself to be reflective and almost deconstruct your inner prejudice and areas like that, or perceptions.
I think that's
which could be quite.
Yeah.
Which could be, well, Mark, also, what key bit of your work has been around looking at teams and team culture in kind of quite extreme situations, and looking at this notion of kind of high performing teams. And I want to kind of talk a bit, because it's such a powerful piece of work, around Camp Bastion and the work that you did there within a medical space, but also in a war zone. Can you kind of, what drew you to study there? What was the kind of reason behind that study?
Yeah, so I just finished a stint with the Cambridge University Boat Club, where I spent a whole season, so it's sort of 7 months full-time, and then stayed another year on a kind of more of a part-time basis. And having finished that and written a book about it, I thought, well, what can I do next? And I was, you know, drawn to just to this idea of people trying to have a go at something and solving problems collectively, but in just unusually difficult circumstances. And the assumption partly is that in these extreme circumstances, we might see tensions that exist in everyday life, but are so subtle, we tend to miss them. And so in more extreme circumstances, they might just be a little bit easier to observe. So I remember reading an article about Camp Bastion in a, I think it was a newspaper. And so I decided to give that a go. And the first answer was no, as you might expect.
Mm-hmm.
And then I found someone a little bit lower down the hierarchy, but still very senior, who had read my rowing work just by coincidence, liked it, and was willing to fight my battle for me. And it took about 16 months to get permission finally. And during that 16 months, I joined the pre-deployment training. I did a bit of teaching for them, you know, pro bono, and just anything I could just to show them that I was serious about wanting to do the work. And they spent that 16 months kind of watching me. Mm-hmm. And finally, I was told, well, here's a flight. You know, you can be on that flight if there's a seat. And that's it. And luckily, wow, there was a seat. And so I was able to go.
So give me a kind of, I don't want to use the word flavor, but the kind of actual, the physical surrounding, the environment, you know, especially for the listeners, you know, are we talking kind of it's military combat zone tents, or we talk, you know, what did it feel like? What did it look like?
So it's very military. I mean, Camp Bastion at the time was almost equivalent to a city like Reading in the UK. Mm-hmm. It's very, very big space. It's the middle of the desert. There's an American camp, there's Camp Bastion, then within Camp Bastion you've got sub-camps, like the Estonians will have their own camp and so on. It is very, very military, meaning that everyone is in uniform, except, of course, the odd person like myself, who doesn't really belong. And it's very unsettling, actually, initially, because when I arrived, I remember being unable to sleep for a good part of a week, and I must have slept, I would have thought. But I felt like I didn't, and it was because of the helicopter noise, you know, because the helicopters are there all the time. They're very loud, and helicopters almost always mean bad news. It is how casualties are being brought back to that hospital. And I found that it took me a while to get used to this. You know, I did enjoy the camaraderie, which in the military can be very strong, and it's something I wasn't used to, and I miss that still. I've never encountered anything like it, and you know, they did take me on board, which was absolutely lovely, and they have a wonderful sense of humor. But it's a different world, you know, from the civilian world, for sure. And so I spend my time living out in a tent, mostly with six or seven other people, doctors. Around the tent, you know, the beds, the cots, you know, people tend to create their own private spaces, which is interesting. And then the hospital was just about a 3 or 4 minute walk away. It's in the middle of the desert. It's 47 degrees in summertime. When I was there in the summer of 2011, it was the bloodiest summer of that war. Partly the reason is that the IEDs became much more powerful than they had been in the, you know, in previous years. Mm. And also, because it's summer, you can still dig in. And so in the wintertime, when the ground is frozen, you get more ballistic injuries. In the summertime, you get the typical double high amputees. And those are injuries that are difficult to survive. What doctors can do in war zones, in some ways, when it comes to these traumatic injuries, is well beyond what people in hospitals typically can do. So they can now save people that they wouldn't be able to save, wouldn't have been able to save a few years ago. I mean, the technology develops very, very quickly. And it's impressive to see how effective they can be as a team around a casualty, where if you don't make a decision very quickly, someone will die. And most of the time it was very, very busy, and the work they would do was, I thought, exceptional.
The previous, I mean, it's kind of interesting. It sounds a little bit kind of completely off the topic here, but isn't the previous podcast I did was around what makes a team successful to become a Michelin star restaurant. It was quite interesting, was this idea of individuality, fluality, and then the unit comes together when it needs to, where the language was one of kind of individual innovation amongst the team to kind of military style formation. And you mentioned this idea of, you know, when the team has to come together, when there's something, what causes that? Is that there's the leader figure, that there's a traditional structure in place? What drives that kind of unity?
So I think what helps is the military training, right? It's quite regimented. It's very disciplined. I think what might help just as much, if not more, is the fact that their purpose is really, really clear. Okay, it's the big silver lining around emergency services. It's slightly perverse, but, you know, as I said, if you don't make the right decision very quickly and you do this collectively, efficiently, someone will actually die. Mm-hmm. And it's often someone wearing the same uniform you are. And I think that really gets people's heads in the right space, you know, and they just get on with it. And I've seen some of the most effective teamwork I've ever seen in otherwise very busy situations where, you know, there's no panic. There is just knuckling down and doing what needs to be done. The converse is also true, whereby if it's not very busy, and because there's not much else to do, boredom sets in. And because I think, by and large, the people that tend to deploy, they tend to pursue this sort of career. You've got people that are often not only very good at what they do, but what makes them good can make them difficult, right? It tends to be quite opinionated, very ambitious. They like to work hard because they like to feel productive. And when suddenly they're faced with empty space, you know, they don't really know what to do. I mean, you can't really go outside because it's so hot outside. You can work out in the gym, but it might consume an hour, something like that. You know, so what else do you do? Well, you know, they start watching movies. What kind of movies? War movies. It's the ultimate irony, you know. And
so that's really interesting that they're watching, that's what they're doing, they're watching war movies.
Not exclusively, but, no, but much of it is. And the irony is, of course, that, you know, it's, you know, what you see in films, it feels very unreal compared to the reality. You know, I remember walking into the doctor's room and they were watching Apocalypse Now, and there's this famous scene, you know, where the helicopters ascend to go and bomb the living daylights out of, I think it's a Vietnamese village. And as I was walking in, the scene was playing, and there's this famous quote of, you know, I love the smell of napalm in the morning. And I'd just been out inspecting the helicopters, and I was thinking, you know, this is ironic, because if you were to open the back door to the doctor's room, you know, you could almost see the helicopters departing in quite a very similar way to what you see in film. So it felt slightly surreal. But I think the more disturbing feature was the fact that they become very unhappy. And when they're unhappy, they start to create work for themselves. So they start to interfere with each other's patients, or they start to hope for new work to come in, you know, so they have something to do. But it, of course, means that people must get hurt in the process, and so they feel guilty about it. Or they bring people back to theater for procedures that may not be emergency procedures, again, to, you know. And so, you know, they become bored. And I left Afghanistan with a very strong sense that there may be nothing more destructive to teams than boredom. It's either boredom of not having enough to do, mm-hmm. or it's a different type of boredom, which is sort of an existential boredom. So you have enough to do, but not enough of what you do is meaningful for you. So I'll give you an example of that. So of the casualties coming in, we had about 174 coming in the first 7 days. So it's very busy. It's a very small hospital. About half are Afghan. And of these Afghans, about 1 in 4, 1 in 5 are children. Now, protocol dictates that, you know, for African patients, typically they need to be shipped out to local hospitals as soon as it's safe to do so, and it might be within 24 hours or so. So they get the same emergency care, but then they need to be shipped out. And the reason I mention this is because for the doctors and nurses, that can be frustrating, because these are people they know they could save. But by virtue of passing them on, you know, there's a real fear that they, that their chances of survival or recovery are compromised because the standard of care is so much lower. And there's some decent evidence to suggest that that's the case. And aside from this, these are the stories going around in the hospital, the expectation that you pass people on. Some of them will die. Had they stayed here, they wouldn't have died. But because we hand them over, because we must, and because we must, we kind of, you know, commit them to a death sentence or something like that. So that gives them a sense that, you know, there's something around the work they do that feels futile. And that sort of boredom is, I think, a kind of boredom that you find quite typically in workplaces today. You know, we're busy. You know, there's lots of emails to take care of and so on, but you know, not everything we do is meaningful. It doesn't feel meaningful. And that can be just as destructive.
But it's an interesting point there. It's got to be thinking, because in the world of, you know, some of the work I do as an executive coach, working with organizations, you know, I'll be going in there kind of saying, what are your values? How do we embed the values in your working culture? But is there something more when you're talking about meaningful? You know, there's this idea of organizations and the values and these type of things, and that's the meaning, that's the purpose. But it feels like there's also the individual sense of meaning and purpose there.
I think that's true. There's a nice piece of work done by Teresa Mbillet. She was a professor at Harvard until she retired, I think, about a year and a half ago. Well known for her work on creativity. And she wrote a book with her husband and partner called The Progress Principle. And in it, she outlines a piece of work she did, where she made a very interesting observation. So I think, and I'm going by memory now, but I think she asked 238 people to keep a diary for 3 months. And you had to be quite diligent about this. You'd write in a diary every day about that day, you know, what made you happy, what made you angry, and so on. And when she had collected the data, so after 3 months she had, I think, just over 12,000 pages, you know, which means that people did a pretty decent job of keeping a diary. She analyzed the data and she found out that actually there seems to be one thing that motivates people like you and I more than anything else, which is the ability for us to make progress, but not in a general sense. The progress towards something that we actually care about, that's meaningful to us. And I always remember that as being quite a powerful insight, actually, you know. And therefore, I think in teams also, it's not just about a team purpose, it's about teasing out what other people go to work to do. Because if you can restructure the workplace in such a way, and this may be difficult, but in such a way that you give people a little bit more opportunity to make progress towards something they actually care about, even if you don't, you know, they should value that.
Yeah. I'm going to want to kind of go back a bit, because you prompted this idea. You talked about when you actually first went to Cambasti and how the team kind of embraced you in, and, you know, there was quite a lot of humor. And it kind of reminded me of my ethnographic research I did in psychiatric hospitals, where humor was a very important part of the culture there, not just within teams, but also between teams and patients. And you talked about the boredom and watching war films. And on a Sunday, I remember one of the patients was allowed to go out with the ward video card to go to the video shop and get a video for the whole war to watch. And it would be things like Once Over the Cuckoo's Nest. So we'd be watching a film about a psychiatric hospital and psychiatric patients in a psychiatric hospital. But that there was a lot of humor. So I would be banded as some type of characters, member of staff, and that would be, you know, and but how important in high performing teams, and I'm putting this in back into Cambastian, is that notion of humor?
I think it's critically important. I mean, it's quite a well known coping mechanism. You know, it's, I don't know how else you would cope unless you were able to make merry, you know, around some quite draconian circumstances. And some of that would mean taking the mickey out of the people you work with, not the patients necessarily, although that may also be part of it. I think it's important. It's one of those things whereby, you know, you never want this to be exposed to outsiders. It's just for, it's a game that's played only by insiders. And if if people in the psychiatric wards let you in on that game, that means that you're an insider. You know, in the same way they let me in. You know, but ordinarily the humor is often so crude and so insensitive to outsiders that it's always an inner game that's played only by those that are truly on the inside.
Yeah, that's okay. And then it would be helpful to kind of get a sense of when we talk about a high performing team. Do you have a sense of what that is? What are the principles to make a high performing team? Do you need to be right on the edge, like in these type of environments, either the psychiatric hospital, Cambastian, or war zone, or we're seeing now in the UK with the NHS and frontline nurses and paramedics, you know? But what is a high performing team?
Yeah, so I think a team can be high performing for some of the time, but not likely for all of the time, if that makes sense. So it's one of those temporal things. But I think what allows a team to be high performing is not necessarily being on the edge, but having a very clear sense of what they are here to do. I think that's absolutely critical. I mean, it's not rocket science. And yet, I'm always surprised, you know, when I work with executives, how little understanding there is sometimes of purpose. And there's some interesting work done at MIT around this, right? And the results are stunning. You know, if you ask people to articulate what they think the three strategic priorities are of the firm, even those in charge find it often quite difficult to do so. Right. So it's very easy to talk about. It's actually very hard to tease out. And I think the beauty of an extreme environment is it's just a little bit more clear. You know, even if it's temporary, it's easy to see. You know, if you deal with an executive team in an average organization, that might just be a little bit harder, but it's absolutely critical. You know, people need to understand what's expected of them, what good looks like, you know, and it needs to be a shared understanding. That's critical. I think that's number one. Number two, people need to feel psychologically safe. And what it means is that it's okay to say, hey, John, can I give you a bit of feedback on something you said yesterday? Are you okay with that, you know? Or can I ask you for some feedback on something that I tried this morning? You know, just a few pointers. I'm just a little bit unsure. You know, or a more extreme version, which I've seen at work in one of the organizations I've spent some time with, where, you know, it becomes a professional obligation to start a team meeting by going to one other person saying, listen, you know, Sarah, there's something I need to tell you that I find it difficult to say to you, you know, but if I were in your shoes, I would love for you to tell me. So here it is. I think people are surprisingly poor at this. They're poor at admitting mistakes, at giving or asking for feedback, at challenging decisions they disagree with. I think mostly because many workplaces aren't psychologically safe. These are places where people don't want to take a risk.
Yeah, and it reminds me a bit of like the classic Irvin Goffman about presentation of the self and preservation of the self. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm going to be wearing different masks in a way to give you the right signs I want you to read me as, but also to protect myself, right? So it's that kind of thing of the workplace becomes this place of performance. And we're going to talk about this later in part two, but about how what that all means in Zoom culture, lockdown culture, the future of work, hybrid, mixed, whatever it is, or work from home, that is reshaping performance. But that's very interesting about high-performing teams and the need for a purpose and a focus. Mm-hmm. And it makes total sense in your example in Cambastian about having that. I think the other thing that we see a lot in business books and TED Talks and, you know, these type of things around team and what makes a team work is it's the collective. It's everyone focusing in the same way. And this notion of the individual becomes a threat. But you talk about that there is the concept of an I in a team. And I'm just wondering if you could say a bit about that.
So the there's an I in team is attributed often to, I think it's Michael Jordan, you know, who made a statement, something like it. And the interpretation of the statement often is, well, you know, there's an ego in a team, and Michael Jordan is well known for having had that ego, you know, and therefore the assumption often is, well, there shouldn't be an I in team at all. Everyone should be equal. There should be no egos. There's no space for egos. I have a slightly different interpretation. So you know, I think there is an IN team, and but I think what it means is that it's really important as a leader to be cognizant of the fact that the people you have in your team are different. You know, there's variety, and that's important for some of the reasons that I think Therese and Abile outlined. You know, people come to work for different reasons. Now, some of these reasons will be shared amongst the people in the team, but it will also be individual reasons. And I think it's really important to tune into those. And so I think one of the most powerful questions you as a leader could ask one of your employees over coffee would be, tell me, what's a good day for you? Mm-hmm. You'd be surprised what you get. You know, people know what a good day is like. People know what a bad day is like. So, you know, when you get people to tell you what a good day is like, it gives you an inkling as to why they come to work. You know, people know about work. And so what I mean by there's an IN team is that. It's having an eye open for how different people are. And different people need different things, as opposed to treating everyone as a homogeneous unit.
That question then, it feels like what it does, it personalizes an experience. And it also creates a contract. You are asking someone what they hope to get from the day. So you're not saying, you know, you're not allowing them to close the question. They can be... decide how honest they want to be back to you, but at least you've kind of got that interaction. You're giving, you're empowering them, which is, that's a very powerful, small, it almost feels like low-hanging fruit, right? Like, why aren't we all doing it? But there must be kind of these drivers that prevent us from doing it, you know, and that's the interesting thing about organizational culture and team culture, that we seem to have these barriers, this kind of need not to do that.
Well, I think there's two reasons for it. I mean, I think there's two reasons for it. Number one, we don't have time. You know, I think that's, you know, or we don't make time for it. I think number two, we don't want to be seen to be intrusive. I mean, we're too polite.
Yeah. So. Yeah, yeah. Am I right also that there's this notion, the difference between teams and working groups? And I'm just, I saw you talking about that. And what are the differences between a team and a working group? And are they both relevant, or is one better than the other?
So it's interesting, right? So I think, gosh, I haven't spoken about it for a long time. So I'm going to have to dig in memory.
I've done my homework. I've been digging stuff out. That, by the way, will all be on the show notes, all the links. So if anyone wants to watch it, I highly recommend that you watch some of Mark's talks.
Thank you. It's so... I don't think necessarily the teams outperform working groups. I think working groups can outperform teams. It depends upon the task, right? So in working group, it's often clear who is in charge. And that person in charge will hold a project. And what typically happens is whoever is in charge will divide a project into bits and give different bits to different people depending on their expertise. And what then happens is interesting because people start to work together by effectively working alone. And so you do your own bit. And then when you're bit, you hand that back over, and then whoever's in charge will kind of bolt the different bits together to create this complete parcel. That's quite typical, I think, of a working group. And the beauty of it is, which is why it can perform well, but the beauty of it is that accountability is straightforward, right? So if something doesn't work, it's not that hard to point a finger because it's very clear where my work ends and your work begins, you know? In a team, that's not always the case, right? So in a team, it can be quite hard to tell where the boundary lies between my responsibility and your responsibility. And therefore, accountability is not as straightforward. But teams can work very, very well in environments where the task is not certain, right? Sort of, it could be innovative environments, could be sort of environments you might have seen in Ken Baston. And where everyone has to kind of pull together and in some ways, you know, balance between following protocol as well as making things up in a moment, kind of collectively and making very quick calls. So I think teams can be harder to get right, actually. And I think teams are also quite rare. You know, I think most of what we call teams aren't teams at all. I think most of what we call teams are actually working groups. And it's okay. It's a bit unfair for working groups to be called the kind of the poor cousin of teams. Because they can be really effective ways of getting work done. They're just not teams. You know, teams are different. You know, teams are mutually accountable as well as individually accountable, whereas working groups are typically just individually accountable, right? So this is a difference. I think teams can outperform working groups by a margin, but it depends on the context.
Thanks for listening to the Decoding Culture podcast. In episode 4, when discussing with the Danish filmmaker Rasmus Dinesen, I stated that team culture will be a key focal point in 2021. I think the conversation with Mark has emphasized the importance of this. Mark and I will carry on developing this in episode 6, where we will discuss the role that conflict plays in organizations and teams. Mark will introduce 6 helpful steps to managing conflict. I will put some of the links to Mark's work in the show notes. If you're interested in organizational culture and how to decode it, I have just started running my training course in partnership with Epic called Leveraging Organizational Culture for Impact. I'll put more details of the course content in the show notes, but keep your eyes open to when I'll be running the course again. Please do subscribe to the podcast feed and please feel free to give the podcast a rating on iTunes. It really helps. To keep up to date with interesting trends on culture, business and anthropology, sign up to my Decoding Culture newsletter. There's also a link in the show notes. See you next time.